Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. On today's show, Diverse Voices Book Review contributor Amanda Moore interviews Walter Greeson and Danian Darrell Jerry, editors of the essay collection Ilmatic Consequences, The Clapback to Opponents of Critical Race Theory.
Today, I am speaking with Dr. Walter Greeson and Mr. Danian Darrell Jerry. Dr. Walter Greeson is the DeWitt Wallace Professor and Chair of the Department of History at McAllister College. He is the preeminent historian of Afrofuturism, the Black speculative arts, and digital economies in the world today. Dr. Greeson has written more than 100 academic articles and essays, and is also the author, editor, and contributor to 18 books, including Suburban Erasure, The Land Speaks, Cities Imagined, Ilmatic Consequences, and the Black Reparations Project. Mr. Danian Jerry is a writer, teacher, and a musician who holds a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. He is a VONA Fellow, which stands for Voices of Our Nation, a fiction editor of Obsidian Literature and Arts in the African Diaspora, and a 2023 Volcanista of Under the Volcano Writers Workshop. His writing appears in Black Panther, Tales of Wakanda, Fireside Fiction, Cracking the Wire During Black Lives Matter, and the Magazine of Fantasy and Fiction, just to name a few. They are both editors of their new book entitled Ilmatic Consequences, The Clapback to Opponents of Critical Race Theory. Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Mm-hmm. Now, just for our listeners, before we start getting into all the questions, can you just give us like a brief synopsis about the book that you've edited and put together for our listeners, please?
Okay, well, I'll start. Ilmatic Consequences, The Clapback to Opponents of Critical Race Theory is a compilation of essays that serves to demystify the controversy surrounding critical race theory. The book lends itself to the argument that has been manufactured and the co-opting of the term critical race theory. So we start by actually presenting essays that explain what critical race theory is, the history of it, the true nature of the discipline. And then we get into the history of the controversy, how the controversy started. And we go from there to solutions that teachers and activists and medical professionals, legal professionals can all use to maintain integrity within their professions and to clap back at this onslaught against Black progressive, I don't want to say politics, but the progression that Black people have made over the past few years, but also what it does is it claps back against the rewriting of history that we're seeing going on. And we go from there to explain or to also show different places where racism is active, but people may not have looked, like in civil planning, for instance.
Now, I have to say that if our listeners want to learn what critical race theory actually is, they should read your book. I believe it lays out a succinct and concrete way from different viewpoints and different related subjects. And so the timing of your book is really quite remarkable considering the current climate that we are dealing with right now. What do you wish for this book to accomplish?
Change the public discourse. For the last 3 years, I've been traveling around the country responding to school districts and to educational leaders who have been under assault by fascists and by some members of their own governments that want to dismantle the high quality of education that we've just begun to offer in the last decade. And so to strike back against folks like Christopher Rufo, who are organizing to silence and dismantle the ways that we actually offer equitable and inclusive education, that's the goal. But beyond that, we want to have the entire population, not just in the United States, but around the world, have the tools necessary to create and maintain just societies. And I've written a lot about the way that people like Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump are attempting to install fascism and authoritarianism around the world. And we see this in the case of the war in Ukraine. But the book contains the tools for citizens to stand up for themselves, to protect themselves from people who don't have their best interests, who want to curtail their rights, who want to take away the right for women to choose the appropriate health care, the right for immigrants to be able to migrate, find jobs, and sustain their families. The book brings to the table all of the ways that we create a society based in Black history and Black studies that actually creates equal opportunity for everyone.
Now, one of your contributors, I believe his name is Lee Ross, he writes the following in his part of the book. He writes, "Overall, the tenets and frameworks of CRT are threatening to some as it illuminates the present and sheds light on our nation's dark past." Why do you think that this anti-CRT movement gathered fire and fuel so quickly? I mean, it has been around for some time. It just seems like these past few years, it's gotten a lot more intense. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, in my opinion, like during the pandemic, after the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, you saw what we all saw. A strong pushback from the people. We saw a galvanization of people fighting for their rights, and not only Black people. Like this was, it was all across the board. White. It was gender fluid, and I think that that struck fear in the heart of conservative America, right? This multifaceted attack, not, I don't want to say attack, this multifaceted response from progressives, right? And progressives joining together and saying, we don't want our country to go down this path.
Now,
I'll add briefly to that. The threat for them, from their perspective, was to Christian nationalism. Mm-hmm. This notion of a white nation based in evangelical Christianity that would define all of the norms, that would define what qualified people to have authority. They saw that slipping away. And so for people in that perspective, nothing could be more terrifying than to have to share power and to have to negotiate about resources with people who don't share their perspective. That's what drove this enormous backlash that we continue to see today.
Now, there's something that I could appreciate as a research person is that all the, for the most part, the essays have, you cite all of the research at the end of the article. It's really quite remarkable. And so, Danian, in one of your chapters, you define what critical race theory actually is. And I'm going to read it back to you so you can hear it. Okay. It says, you said, critical race theory includes a complex methodology and perspective applied by legal professionals seeking to reevaluate and recontextualize racism as it relates to the people in power who create and enforce laws and public policy in the United States. So it's a complex but a clear definition. And so why do you feel that so many people get it wrong?
Well, I think, in my opinion, I think it's due to, in part, to media. I think that people get it wrong because before Christopher Rufo went on Tucker Carlson Tonight, many people outside of academia had never heard of critical race theory. So Christopher Rufo goes on Tucker Carlson Tonight and he describes critical race theory. And I specifically remember from reviewing his interview, he referred to it as an existential threat to the United States. And so because he sort of presented this definition first, that's kind of what people go with. And since the controversy around it became so vitriolic, right? People started fighting back against it. So even people who were standing up for progressives, Blacks, people of color, they were fighting back against the definition that people like Christopher Rufo and Donald Trump and Glenn Youngkin had already established. I knew it was something wrong because when I looked at the Christopher Rufo interview, I noticed that he never mentioned Derrick Bell. He mentioned Kimberlé Crenshaw. He didn't mention the actual architects of it, right? He just basically said that it's poison in the mind. I'm not quoting him, but basically what he was saying is that this is something that is poisoning the minds of children in schools, dividing children, right? Race blame. And he uses all of these terms. So I feel as though since he went on Tucker Carlson and he kind of like gave his own definition of it, that was the first thing that people heard, the first thing that people saw, and that's kind of what they went with. And even the people who were thinking that they were standing against him were actually perpetuating the definition that he brought, if that makes any sense.
Okay, yes, it does. And so, Walter, in your introduction, you wrote, and that kind of segues to this, you wrote that this book provides the tools to restore peace and civility in the next century. And so just reflecting on what Daniel just said regarding the divisiveness that we're seeing, do you still believe that it's possible, especially in our society today, that we can restore peace and civility?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was just part of a meeting yesterday that we're seeing the success of people using the tools that we describe in the book to restore the way that everyone has access to a high quality education in places like Florida, in Virginia, in Texas. And so these folks are literally hour by hour, minute by minute, every single day, holding meetings at the community level. I think my favorite story came from Marvin Dunn, who was at Florida International. And then he has stood up and purchased a couple acres of land in Rosewood, Florida. And he's bringing people on tours under DeSantis's so-called rule dictatorship, where he's given tours about African-American history and the history of racial violence in Florida. And then a white nationalist tried to intimidate him about a year ago. He was out there with the folks putting together the tour. And this guy used his truck to try and run everybody over. He was spinning out and braking and trying to hit everybody. They called the police. A few days later, they arrested this guy. Then about a week after the arrest, Marvin went and filed federal hate crimes charges against him for having done this assault. Just last week, this man was sent to prison. He's facing up to 60 years in prison for this assault against Marvin Dunn and his colleagues. And this is what we need to be prepared to do wherever we go now. Frankly, I'm prepared to do it here in Minnesota with the work that I do, is that there are people who try to shut down the kind of inquiry we have. But this is how we say this intolerance, this hatred, this violence is intolerable. We should have done it more forcefully during the Reconstruction period, and especially at the end of the 19th century against former Confederates. We should have done it against the white citizens' councils that came out of the civil rights movement. But this is now the time to confront this forcefully, shut it down, and this book is at the forefront.
Now, you also wrote that the crisis is now, the clapback is here, and the consequences cannot be denied. And then you have in your book the sections of crisis, the clapback, and the consequences. And so I really thought that was a good way to organize it. But just for our listeners that don't understand, can you tell them what clapback means?
Oh.
Some folks are still learning. Okay.
Yeah, no, this is a long tradition in the Black community that when someone opens their mouth with the wrong tone, the wrong approach, they got the wrong information, somebody who's got better will get up and let me tell you what we have to say about this. That is the clapback. Like, it is just a way that we communicate to let know that there's got to be some corrections. There's going to have to be some changes. Lies are being perpetuated. I honestly dream of the day that somebody is on a show with Christopher Rufo and Tucker Carlson and will lay the clapback on both of them.
Yes.
So did you, because you have these different sections in trying to tackle the attacks on critical race theory and the different history of it, but you have a lot of talented writers and authors who are contributing to this. How did you decide which author would tackle which section or which subject?
Well, we put the call out and we basically described what we wanted in the call. And we made sure to tell possible contributors to consider the fact that this book is not only about critical race theory, but it is also about the manufactured argument. It is also about the co-opting. So basically, we took the essays in and we kind of looked at them and figured out, okay, which sections are proper for which essays. To be honest with you, the writers pretty much came up with their own subjects. It just so happens that we were able to get essays from a diverse base of academics, activists, and creatives. So it kind of came together on its own, but I don't want to take any of the credit from the contributors. They're all great minds, and they all sort of took that call that we put out and they kind of ran with it and did their own thing. And then we kind of organized that.
Now yeah. In the
For me, it's very much like an orchestra or a chorus. You know, you're hearing the sopranos, you're hearing the tenors, you're hearing the baritones. And the way you put it together is just to kind of respect where the talent, where the genius is. And that let us just see as we read through the pieces, oh, this is just a magnificent, unique composition. And at the center of it, of course, our collaborator, Stacey Robinson's art that, for me, if like there are lots of reasons about the book, but the art at the center of it that Robinson produced is just monumental. It's some of the best work people will ever see. I think that'll be the source of galleries for decades and centuries to come.
Now, in the one of the sections, you really hit on current issues. And I know sometimes in the publishing world, when you start on something, it's years later before you get it, but you include the murder of George Floyd, you include what happened to Breonna Taylor, and you look at the history of how hip hop has always been at the forefront of these issues, and many people have never observed that. So can you explain why you chose to examine hip hop and to incorporate it into the critical race theory conversation?
Well, there are a few reasons. One reason was to give the book a language that was accessible to a wider range of people. Also to address the fact that many people who grew up in that 90s era who listen to Illmatic are actually mature scholars now. We're grown up. We have things to say, right? So that's another reason. Also, hip hop is not only the language of the people, but hip hop gave voice to the voiceless. Hip hop itself is a tool of marginalized people. So that's why we wanted to incorporate hip hop. Also, one of the tenets of critical race theory relates to first person narratives, storytelling, learning about people by listening to people. So we looked at Illmatic, the album, as just a great example of storytelling and storytelling that reveals the plights of Black people. And not only the plights of Black people, but the plights of impoverished people, I was also saying.
And so there are some other, one thing I noticed in your book, there are a lot of one-liners. When I say one-liners, I'm talking about someone gets that sentence and you can just look at that sentence and understand. I'm mentioning Lee Ross again because I did see his section as first up front. Here are some of the lines that he says. Culture wars over CRT have turned school boards into battlegrounds. When referring to people of color, he writes that they are no longer asleep at the wheel of injustice. And part of another quote was CRT is what is a critical examination of the American legal education and medical systems. Do you have any thoughts about when you mentioned, Walter, about having to see what school districts are going through? And in one of the chapters, this kind of segues to what CRT is. You said that only recently has the United States chosen to love Black people. Do you have any thoughts on why is this the case at this point in history and how that coincides with the CRT debate?
And so you get right to the core of it. So building off the storytelling point, those lines that you mentioned, those particular moments, are reflective of the aesthetic in the book that is definitively hip hop. It's like you have different MCs rhyming over different beats from chapter to chapter. And, you know, in any classic hip hop, in any lyric, there's going to be a punchline. There's going to be that line that sticks in your head that you're like, I remember that song forever off of that line. We were talking a little bit about it before the show came on. And so those pieces are definitely the way that we saw the writers because of where they came from. They were delivering those, and it just makes the entire experience memorable. Beyond that, to the larger piece you're getting at, is that as you go through and you do your reading, you're hearing it, you're feeling it as you go through the text, that piece grows and grows. And you talk about this piece in the chapter where I was pulling in some of my autobiographical material. And that piece is also kind of the growth of the storytelling, is that there's an authenticity to hip hop because it's grounded in the person's experience, in their history. They're saying things that they hadn't been able to say publicly before. And so that is tremendously empowering to the people who read and listen to it, that they begin to have confidence in asserting their own voice. And that's the way that we change policy. That's the way that we actually begin to build new institutions that actually serve humanity, that actually have human dignity at the core of what we're trying to accomplish. We don't have to accept the barriers that came from enslavement or from segregation. We have to really build a world almost from scratch. Although I do argue that we have some antecedents in indigenous African and global indigenous cultures, that we don't have to accept white supremacy and these ideas that these religious hierarchies have to be the basis of the way our world works. So now we've turned it into a lot of money and financial institutions, the way people get access to resources, but we can redesign all of it so that it's healthier and better for everyone.
Hey, now that actually segues to Dangan. You interviewed Matthew Broaddus, and this was one of the sections, I think chapter 10 was decolonizing public minds in public places. And so in response to one of the questions that you asked, I believe he said, we want living books, books that are relevant, books that allow us to talk about difficult subjects, books that allow us to engage and wrestle with profound ideas. Mm-hmm. We have an information gathering culture, thanks to the internet, of course. But before that, our books and our libraries, and I know you're probably currently aware of some of the attacks we've had on libraries and book banning in schools. Is in this interview that you did, is he saying that limiting knowledge limits our society's potential? Is that what you were hearing in that interview?
Yes, that is what I was hearing. And also I was hearing that not only limiting knowledge is limiting our society's potential, but also the importance of giving knowledge to young people. Also, like the importance of giving a broad range of perspectives, especially historical perspectives and literary perspectives, to young people, people that are in that age where their minds are still learning and developing. That is so important, right? Because if kids don't learn history and as the way it actually happened, or if they're only given one perspective, when they grow up, they're gonna lean on that. And even if they hear another perspective, or if they learn a lie, and even if they learn a lie when they're young, even if they learn the truth when they're older, they're more likely to believe what they learned first, right? So curating libraries, making sure that children have broad, progressive curriculums to learn from, that is so important. That also makes me think about Michael A. Gonzalez's piece, Black Noise Whitewash. And he brought up something that I had never really thought about. He brings up the importance of teaching Black music history in public school. Children actually learning about the roots of American soul music, where it came from, the fact that this music really comes from the plantations, right? When you go from spirituals to the blues to pretty much rhythm and blues, which is R&B. And to show that Black people had a very, very, very important, very major stake in that, right? So and by teaching that, you bolster children, you uplift them, you strengthen them, you give them a broader base, right? So that's kind of what I got from what Maurice was saying, the importance of making sure that young minds have tools and the information that they need to develop properly.
Now, in the book, you have sections that are, of course, well-researched. And so for someone who's studying it, they can go to those resources, see, you know, where it's coming from and really kind of pull from that. But you also give a little bit of Wakanda to those of us, those of us who are Black Panther fans. And so it's interesting when you were talking about kids. And forgive me, I wasn't sure if it was Walter or Daniel, you Walter or Daniel, who wrote about Wakanda. Saying Wakanda, oh, Walter, okay. Wakanda became a vision of a world without enslavement, segregation, or injustice. It offers the reality that white nationalists cannot permit the world to create. And you talked about this under the branch of Afrofuturism. And so can you tell our listeners about that? And do you think that this is why Black Panther, the movie, the part that we saw, resonated with so many people? Can you kind of tell us about that, please?
Yeah, so there's a trajectory that defines the book, but it defines really the confrontation we're in, is that Black Studies emerges in the late 1960s and begins to challenge the way the academy functions. It then lays the foundation for a lot of what becomes hip hop in terms of musical expression through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And so that then shapes a new sense of consciousness in politics, not just in the United States, but around the world. And ultimately, that's the seed of Afrofuturism since 2015, that when we have Black Lives Matter emerge as a protest movement, simultaneously, a group of artists who came up through hip hop, through Black science fiction, Cherie Renee Thomas as a particular keystone for this particular emergence. This work basically opens the door for us to break the shackles of our imagination and what we consider possible. And so I was working on ideas about what Wakanda could be in comics from like 2002, 2003. I taught my first course about Wakanda and Black spatial architecture back in 2002. And Marvel saw what we had done with the Black Panther comic. They named me a Wakandan ambassador. And so it was pretty hilarious. And then got to work with Christopher Priest and Reginald Hudlin, talking with them almost every day online for about a decade, and reshaped what was going into the comics. And Hudlin in particular laid the blueprint for becoming a film. So in 2007, I published essentially an online encyclopedia about if Wakanda was going to be shown in a movie or a television show, how important it was to make it as realistic as possible, to ground it in African and African diaspora history. And so, you know, this is, what was it, the next year Iron Man came out and started to show people that these kind of films could be financially viable. But we were waiting, you know, as a community, like, okay, at some point there's going to be a Black Panther story. And so it was 2016. They came out with Civil War, was a Marvel cinematic movie. And that film featured the Black Panther. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, the movie is going to be here quickly. And so that's when we pulled all the resources together, published the Wakanda syllabus. And I remember in January of 2018, syllabus had been out for 2 years. We're up in Harlem for a giant celebration of Black comics. And we had actors from the film prior to its release up on stage talking about the influence of all these ideas. And so it was just amazing to see it when it actually happened. All of us thought the movie would do well. None of us anticipated just how deeply it would change everything. And so 2019, 2020, we're thinking about how we're going to take on this project. Everyone is fascinated with what's possible with Afrofuturism. I want to say Ronaldo Anderson, Io Sakai, who are our guides in this work with Universal Right Publishing. They basically opened the door for us with a Carnegie Hall conference on Afrofuturism in New York City. And that's when we started to gather all the papers that would become the chapters in the book. And so Afrofuturism is a way of reimagining our world without this 500-year period of colonization and enslavement. And that's what Wakanda put on screen for everybody, to say, this is, we could have been much healthier, much stronger, much, much better as people if we had this kind of moral compass earlier. And so the fictional universe is just giving us some imagery and some ideals to aspire towards. But the reality of it is, and this is what the third chapter does, I believe, particularly I think about C&E Corbin's chapter and also Asher Kreiner's chapter on Detroit, is that, and there are people literally doing this work as scholars, as public policymakers right now, how do we build and restore Black and Indigenous communities? And that's the work, you know, here in St. Paul, if you look up Rondo Reconnect, Rondo is R-O-N-D-O. Rondo Reconnect, it's a community destroyed by a major highway. And we're rebuilding a land bridge to restore those homes, to bring the shops back, and to actually heal that community after 60 years of real suffering. So this is true for over 2,000 communities across the United States. We're able to pull a lot of support from state and federal government to rebuild Black communities. And so that's something that wasn't possible when we started the 21st century.
Now, one of the things that you, I think you have another contributor by the name of Odell Hall. And this contributor wrote that one could argue that the entire chronicling of American history is an ongoing information war designed to remove the ability of African Americans to self-determine and to find their own place and acquire a piece of the American enterprise. And I remember reading that part about Rondo, about how it was an interstate, right? That was went right through the community. And when you do things like that, you chip away at history and at people's livelihoods and neighborhoods. So do you believe that at the heart of all of this, that it's really about change? And like many things in life, people don't want to do it. It's too painful. It's too uncomfortable. What are your thoughts on that?
Go ahead.
Oh, my fault.
I thought you were going to answer you. Go ahead. I can do it.
You want me to jump it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's definitely that. Like, that's the conservative movement relies on this sense that, oh, yeah, everything is good. We don't need to change anything. You know, just make people adapt to what we currently have. And they never want to hear from people who say, no, what we have isn't working and it hasn't worked. It's never worked. Not for my parents, not for my grandparents. Like, we have to fundamentally change. And ultimately, not just the Black experience, but also Indigenous people and immigrants and women as a gender, you know, particularly, you know, Danian says this piece about gender fluid folks. Change is essential for them to live, to thrive. Yeah. And that's the majority of people. We must evolve. And so, yeah, change is uncomfortable for folks who are happy with the status quo and it's worked for them for a while, but that's not the majority of people, especially in the global society. And so we need to engage. And there is an enormous amount of change happening. The people who try to deny that are really trying to take control and continue to dominate the people around them. And so that's the piece that troubles me is, you know, we see these politicians that were just on the debate stage, wherever they come from, and they're interested in just dominating their neighbors, dominating the people they disagree with. And that's impermissible. And that, Danian, just give me 1 minute to like expand for a second. I want to stand up for you and the courage you've shown in the last week or two. There's been some online attacks directed in your direction. And Danian is a champion. Danian is a man who takes the fight to the front line and does not allow people to spout nonsense. And so I wanted to just go on the record publicly with my respect and admiration and total support for everything you have said and done, especially in the last 2 weeks to a month, but really throughout your life, man. Thank you up front for what you do and know that you got armies behind you.
And do either of you believe that as more stories are finally told and published, that the influx of these lost histories will change a person's mindset?
I'll take that one. I just want to share a brief story of my own. I turned 50 this year, just like hip hop. Actually in New York, and I went on a little pilgrimage. KRS-One threw a free concert in the South Bronx, right at 1520 Sedgwick. Like, it's one of the birthplaces of hip hop. So I said, okay, I'm going. I had to catch a subway. I had to catch a bus. I had to walk through this park. I had to go through a broken fence. I was like, I can see one of the reasons that people were like drawn to this, because you have to go through a lot to get there. It's not like it wasn't easily accessible. But when I got there, it was the concert was amazing. And Benjamin Crump, there were hip hop artists from Public Enemy to CL Smooth. Like, there were a lot of people there. KRS-One, it was fantastic. But Benjamin Crump was there. And he came on stage and he spoke and he said, hip hop is important because the rappers help to carry the history, especially in these times where you have conservative forces sort of trying to rewrite history and reframe it. So he said, hip hop is Black history. And he had the crowd chanting it, and it was just so powerful. And I couldn't help but think about the book. And Rhonda Rashad Penrice, in particular, her essay chronicles the history of hip hop educating the masses. So the only thing I want to add to that is that I don't think that it's just hip hop, and I don't think that it's just the rappers. I think that the history is in us, all of us, and it's up to us to carry it forward. The same way that my granddad told me stories about his experiences as a sharecropper, you know, that sort of thing. So I think that it's up to all of us to chronicle our history and tell it, whether we're telling it in the classroom or whether we're telling it to our children at home or our friends or whatever.
So I have one last question for you. And it is, I think, Walter, you wrote this, let these chapters offer a step forward in understanding our power and abolishing our fears. From what you have seen and observed since publishing this book, is our society on its way there to a place that abolishes fears?
So that's always an ongoing challenge, and it comes back around just periodically. Yes, is the answer directly to your question. At the moment, I saw this backlash take hold and attempt to lie. Like, we got to say up front, Christopher Rufo's interview and his proposition is fundamentally a lie, and we got to call a lie a lie. And we saw this happen in Atlanta, where these people had to come in and take their mugshots. It's like, they're liars. And like, we need to say that up front. Once we start to do that and we provide the evidence and the ways that we kind of have courage, yes, we're moving towards abolishing our fear. You know, we look back to someone like Franklin Roosevelt saying the only thing that we have to fear is fear itself. And I've had some personal revelations in the last week or so that really drove home for me that there is nothing to fear. Fear is the killer, the crippler. And that when we reach the moment where we're in touch with our courage, when we fulfill our vision and stand by it, no matter what adversity we face, that's when the miracles happen. And so for me, we're on the cusp of that. I think this next 2, 3, 4 years, a lot of people are going to be discovering their power. And then this book is definitely a tool to help them get there.
Daniel, would you like to add to that?
Yes. I also agree that we are on the way to abolishing fear. And And that's my southern accent makes me say fear, but fear, yes. And I think that that's been going on for quite some time. And I think that that's part of the issue. That's part of the controversy, that there are certain powers that want us to be afraid, right? And no matter what they do, we stand up. No matter how much they try to suppress our voices, we come through. No matter how much they try to silence us, if we speak, right? And we are not deterred, and we won't be deterred.
Thank you both. Dr. Walter Greeson and Daniel Jerry are the editors of Illmatic Consequences, the Clapback to Opponents of Critical Race Theory. You can read more about Dr. Greeson at walterdgreeson.com and follow him on Twitter X at Walter D. Greeson and Mr. Danyan Jerry on Twitter X at Danyan Jerry. Thank you both for speaking with us at Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you, Amanda. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.